This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest, actor Christopher Eccleston, co-stars in the HBO series The Leftovers. He plays a minister coming to grips with the aftermath of an apocalyptic event. 2% of the world's population has mysteriously disappeared. People left on Earth are distraught and becoming a little undone in their desperate search for meaning and comfort. The Leftovers' third and final season premieres Sunday. Eccleston also co-starred in the British TV series The A-Word, about a family dealing with a 5-year-old son on the autism spectrum. And he was in the films Let Him Have It, Shallow Grave, and Gone in 60 Seconds, and the British TV series Cracker. He played Doctor Who for one season. Terry spoke to Christopher Eccleston last July.
Christopher Eccleston, welcome to Fresh Air. First, I want to talk with you about a series that you're known for in the U.S., the HBO series The Leftovers. Mm-hmm. And this is a series that starts when there's some kind of event, when about 2% of the world's population just vanishes. And no one really knows whether this is this a religious event, like the rapture, or is this some kind of supernatural, inexplicable event? And so, you know, people are just unhinged, and like new religions are starting up because nobody believes in the old ones anymore. Other people are getting more committed to their older religions. You play a minister who believes that the Great Departure, as it's known, isn't an act of God, because bad people, people who were, you know, people have done bad things, vanish. So if it was the rapture, only good people would have been lifted up to heaven. So you've been going around trying to, like, prove to people that people have disappeared. There's some bad people there.
And buried in that, of course, is his own ego. That, I mean, basically what he believes is, if it would have been the rapture, he would have been taken, because he believes himself to be such a faithful servant to the Lord.
Right, and he's tried to become more deeply committed to his faith and to hold on to his church. But he's a little unhinged.
A little unhinged too. He initially goes through a great spiritual crisis, but then lights upon the idea that he is Job of the Bible and the chosen one, in that the Lord has chosen him to punish him in order to test his faith. So his reaction, eventually, after a period of bitterness and anger and railing, is to restate his faith and re-entrench his faith. And he identifies very strongly with the Job of the Bible, who, of course, we know had great many wives, great riches, and was God's chosen one. And then Satan challenged the Lord and said, "I can make him turn against you." So that has been a guiding idea for us throughout the series.
Well, there's a great Job scene, and you walked us right into it. So let's hear that scene. So your character, the Reverend Matt Jameson, has gone to a town that has been spared from the Great Departure. Nobody in this town vanished. And it's now considered a sacred, holy, safe space. And so he and his wife have managed to become residents there. And she's in a kind of vegetative state ever since the day of the departure. She's been neither here nor there. She's been physically on Earth with her eyes open during the day, but there's absolutely nothing that registers on her. So he has taken her in a car and a wheelchair to the doctor and had to leave this special town to do it. And on the way back, he and his wife are mugged. Their wristband, which is their ID to get back into town, is stolen from them. And so he's trying to get back into town with his wife, who's in a wheelchair, and he can't do it. And the only way he can do it is through this smuggler, who says, "For $500, I can smuggle you back into this town." He doesn't have the money. But your character sees a woman standing next to a Winnebago with a big cross on it. So he decides, being a reverend, he decides to approach her and ask her for help. She's played by Brett Butler. Her name, the character's name, is Sandy. Here's the scene. And my guest, who you'll hear in the scene, is Christopher Eccleston.
Sandy, I'm asking for your help. I'm calling upon your sense of community and charity. Mary and I need some money so that I can get
How much?
$500. I know that's an extraordinary amount of money, but I give you my word as a Christian, I will pay you back.
What denomination?
20s. Whatever you can...
No, you're a reverend. What denomination?
Episcopalian.
Why?
My father was a reverend. I was raised in the faith, but I welcome all beliefs into my church.
Where'd you go to seminary?
Berkeley Divinity.
Where's that?
Connecticut.
What's your favorite book of the Bible? You got a favorite book?
Job.
What's his wife's name?
She isn't named. And she speaks only once. Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die.
Wait right here.
Good thing I didn't say Lutheran.
That's my guest, Christopher Eccleston, in a scene
from
The Leftovers.
She's such a sensational actress.
Yeah, and later in this episode, to further punish herself in a Job-like way, you climb onto a rooftop and put yourself naked in a pillory.
On the top of a taco stand, yeah.
Yeah, just a kind of bizarre scene. But anyway, I know that you're agnostic. Or atheist, I'm not sure which way you identify.
You know, I'm no longer sure now. I'd certainly made great play a number of years ago about my atheism, and things have changed in my life. And I know I'm no longer so certain. So I guess I would have to say agnostic now.
Really? Can you talk about what's changed?
Children. I had children. I have two very beautiful and center of my life children, Albert and Esme. I lost my father. I watched him suffer through his dementia. I had my own crisis earlier in the year. Life has happened to me, I would say. Life.
So,
and maybe some of the issues and the leftovers, my relationship with Damon Lindelof, the showrunner. Remember, we had quite a discussion on faith. He claims that I said that because Matt Jameson in the novel on which the series is originally based only appears for two pages, so Damon was very surprised that I was pursuing that role. But I pointed out to him that, you know, it's a great dramatic character, an Episcopalian reverend who possibly was not taken in a biblical rapture. It's just there for the taking. But he claims that I said that the man's reaction to that would be to become more religious. I don't remember saying that, but that's what Damon claims. But we had a discussion about faith, and Damon said, look, I that's a very difficult question to answer, because I said, are you a believer, you know? And I find myself there now, really.
So is having witnessed your children's birth and early development and your father's death made you feel the need to believe in something or feel the presence of something in your life?
I just feel that when I was stomping around saying I was an atheist, I was not thinking about it enough. I think I mean, there is certainly a huge part of me that feels intense anger against organized religion. But I do feel at the moment a little more spiritually open to what may be religious beliefs. I mean, if anything, Buddhism is, which is a philosophy, of course, the thing that makes the most sense to me, I would say.
It's interesting that playing a part in The Leftovers is one of the contributing things that led you in that direction.
Yes, Matt's, the complexity of Matt Jameson's reactions to events in his life.
Did reading the book of Job also make you think about religion?
Well, I had an extraordinary experience with the book of Job. I was invited to Westminster Cathedral to celebrate the anniversary of the publication of the King James Bible. And I was positioned in a very sacred area of Westminster Cathedral, and they asked me to read Job. And I read Job, the section where God turns on Job and says, who are you to question me? Did you create the stars? Did you create the sea? This extraordinary, dramatic moment. And I was asked to read that text in front of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, his name escapes me, but one of his distinctive features was he had very pronounced eyebrows. And when I finished it, I glanced at him and he waggled them at me as if to say, that's got you thinking, hasn't it, son? And then about a year later, I'd taken my mother on holiday to Cornwall in the southwest of England to give her a break from my father. And we walked into a tiny, tiny church on the coast of the Lizard Peninsula. There was just myself and my mum in there, the 300, 400-year-old church, tiny. And the book was open, and I, being an actor, of course, I went and stood there, and the book was open at Job, the same section I'd read 2 years earlier in Canterbury. And I read it, and my mum has a very strong faith, and I read it out loud, and she looked at me and she said, oh, you did that very well. I said, well, I've rehearsed it, Mum. So, and then, of course, I run into Damon Lindelof and all his crazy ideas about Job and Matt Jameson. So there's some kind of link here.
Because I know you best from The Leftovers, when I hear your voice in my head until seeing the A word, I thought of you as having an American accent, which, of course, you don't. You're from the UK.
That's correct, yeah.
And now I'm hearing you on the A word. But is the accent you use on the A word the same way that you're speaking to us now?
Yes, yes. I come from Salford, which is right next door to Manchester, famous, among other things, for producing Albert Finney and Mike Lee. And so I have a Salford accent, which has been softened over the years because I moved to London, and Londoners tend to be very lazy about trying to understand thick accents. So myself and my Scottish and Liverpudlian friends slightly neutralised our accents. But yeah, that I'm speaking as I based that performance on my father. Morris is based really on my father, Ronald Joseph Eccleston.
And he worked in factories, right?
He did. He worked in an American factory.
In England?
Yes, in Trafford Park in Salford. The Colgate Palmolive. They called it a soap works, but it did much more than soap, toothpaste, deodorant, etc., shampoo, washing up liquid. And that's where he met my mother. They met in Colgate Palmolive. My father came down in a lift on his forklift truck. The doors opened and there stood my mother. And my mother said she looked at him and thought, oh, he's a bit of all right, but I can tell he's moody. And
I
said
to her, accurate diagnosis?
Yeah, absolutely accurate. And I said to my mom, how did you know that he fancied you? How do you know that he was interested in you? And she said, well, as the lift, as he reversed into the lift after he'd done whatever he was supposed to do, and as the lift doors were closing, he never took his eyes off me. And I was surprised at how cinematic my mother's description of that was. Amazing.
So when you're playing an American, as you do in The Leftovers,
yep,
what do you think of as being the distinctive characteristics of American speech?
American speech, a very good question. Well, first of all, you locate it very specifically. And I was, you know, I spoke to Damon about that. Damon was very funny on day one because I stay in the accent when I'm on set, you know, not because I'm a method actor, just for muscle memory, you know. And he said to me, he came on set, he was obviously very harassed, first day of shooting this huge series for HBO, and he said, is that your American accent? I said, yeah. He said, it's great. But even if it hadn't been great, even if it had been shit, I'd have told you it was great. And he disappeared. I love him for that. I'll never forget that. And my accent has improved over the three seasons. It was shaky in season one. It got much more secure in season two, and is, I believe, will be even better in series three. It was a huge challenge for a British actor to be totally surrounded by American actors who were simply speaking how they would speak, and to adopt that accent. It's taken a great deal of work and dedication, but I've loved it because I use a different voice for Matt than I've done before. I've never really altered my voice for a character, but my register is lower because that helps me achieve some of the sounds. So it's been a fascinating and scary experience, I have to say, you know.
So you've spoken in the British press about how actors with working class accents are being shut out of certain roles. Do you feel like your accent has shut you out of roles?
Well, really, it's more about over the last 10 years, the arts policies in our country has meant that people from working class backgrounds are not getting the places at drama schools. We are not producing working class actors anymore.
I see.
That was what I was saying. And consequently, you know, our culture is, you know, all the actors are white, male, and middle class, which is not good for the culture. That's what that's about. And yes, there is a, you know, anybody who knows Britain knows that class is the key to everything. And for some reason, there is this great lie that Shakespeare must be spoken in Queen's English, received pronunciation. There's an association with that accent. It apparently denotes higher poetic feeling and greater intelligence, which is absolute nonsense, you know? Shakespeare, for instance, would never have sounded like, with great respect, the Queen. It would have been filled with intonations from all over the country. So that's what concerns me, the class system, really, and the fact that actors like me from a working class background are now not being given the opportunities.
So you said this is something that's happened in the past 10 years. What's changed?
A Conservative government does not help at all. They are overly concerned with the welfare of white middle class males, and they are not particular. They don't see culture, theatre, film, television, dance. They don't see it as central to a country's identity and understanding of itself. There's a great philistinism in the Conservative Party, in my opinion. Arts are just kind of a nice diversion with a bottle of wine, rather than something hugely important in understanding society and life.
How do you think Brexit is going to affect the arts in England and in Europe in general?
Brexit was an absolute disaster, and I am deeply ashamed of my country. It's a disaster. It's the isolationism. It's Little Englander. You will note that Scotland and Ireland voted to remain. As for the impact on the culture, I just feel it will probably make it more white. And we are not a white country. We are a cosmopolitan, multi-faith country. And I'm sure if you are in a minority in this country, you're going to be worried now. We have made a huge step backwards. It's a disgrace. But I can understand why people voted out. I get it. You know, they're scared. They are basically... It comes down to this. If you've got money, like I have, you vote to remain. If you've not got money, you vote out. So we have lost to these people. Our successive governments have created a disenfranchised group of English people who want out of Europe. That was created by us, our policies.
Yeah. You know. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Let me read.
Please don't. Please appeal to the rest of the world. Please don't give up on us. Please.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're listening to Terry's interview with actor Christopher Eccleston. He plays a minister on the HBO series The Leftovers, which begins its third and final season Sunday night. Eccleston also co-starred in The A Word, a BBC series shown last year on Sundance TV, which is now available on iTunes and Amazon. A second season of The A Word is now in production. The series is about a couple who've learned their 5-year-old son is on the autism spectrum. disrupting the plans and assumptions about their lives made by the parents, their teenage daughter, and their extended family. The show is set in a small town in northern England. Eccleston's character, the boy's grandfather, lost his wife the year before and is in the process of retiring. He started taking singing lessons. Here he is with his teacher, taking a lesson at her house.
A movie queen to play the scene of bringing all the good things out of me. But for now, love, let's be real. I never thought I could feel this way, and I've got to say that it's a bloody hell.
I'm shouting again, aren't I?
Yes, you lost the breathing. When you're letting out the final breath on the note, think what it's like to hold in a fart and then finally relax and let it go.
I've never held a fart in my life.
Well, maybe you should start. Otherwise, good, Maurice. Not bad at all.
Don't patronise me, Louise. I've not been practising. There's been stuff at home.
Oh, sorry to hear that. Have you got a moment? I've a proposal to put to you.
Not really, no.
It won't take long. Sit down and make some tea.
Before you ask, I do not want to take up the ukulele.
This is what I'm thinking. That you're alone and I'm alone, and neither of us are particularly short of commitments or company. You with your family and your business, and me with the teaching and the choir and Ralph, but...
Louise, come on.
Here's the but. I'm just going to say it. I miss sex, do you?
I'm sorry?
I miss sex.
I'm sorry to hear that. Have you thought about the internet?
Oh, it's nasty out there, Maurice. So I was thinking that you and I should perhaps start a sexual relationship. It strikes me as a practical solution. We're neither of us teenagers and we know our needs and we seem to like each other. And I can see the thought horrifies you, so I'll say no more about it.
Well, it's not bad.
Perhaps you don't miss the sex.
Not that either. I don't find you... I don't think of you in that way.
Oh.
I'm kind of wishing this conversation had been about a ukulele.
So at the beginning of that scene, is that you doing your best at singing, or are you singing in character?
That's an interesting question. I listened to it and I thought, I can sing better than that. Well, I don't know. Maybe I was doing my best. I thought I sounded a lot better on the day.
Did you?
I love that song, Gordon Lightfoot. I love that scene. Was really the scene that made me desperate to play the part more than any other. I just loved him, that man, singing that song.
That song is If You Could Read My Mind. What is it about that song that you think is so right for that character?
Well, it's so wrong for that character, actually, I think, If You Could Read My Mind, because it's so romantic and expressed and heartfelt, and he has problems with that kind of thing.
So I figure your character is taking singing lessons for a reason, and in my mind, I haven't seen the whole first season yet, my mind is going to lead somewhere. And maybe not just to an affair with a teacher, because his grandchild is on the autistic spectrum and is obsessed with music. I'm seeing a possible bond here between the grandchild and the singing teacher.
I think that's true, but I think it's unconscious. It wasn't plotted. I mean, one of the key things about Maurice is that he is in the early stages of grief for his wife, who he lost to cancer within the last 2 years. And he really is at sea without her. And I think he is very much a type A character, but he's slowly giving up his business to his young son. Yeah, the brewery. And so he's trying to find things to do, self-improvement. And then he accidentally stumbles on this music teacher who, myself and Pookie Cannell, who played the role, decided that she had been a friend of Maurice's wife. That's how the connection was made.
And incidentally, myself and Pookie Cannell were sweethearts when we were 17.
Oh, no.
And we've retained our friendship for over a 35-year period.
So you've already had a relationship.
Yeah, it was chaste. It was a chaste sweetheart relationship, but it's grown into this extraordinary friendship. And when we were given the opportunity to work together, for the second time actually in our careers, because we met before we were actors, we snatched it. We really snatched it. I love her very much, and she's it's a fantastic performance, I think.
As you pointed out, your character in The A Word is not very expressive.
That's right.
And now he's learned that his grandson is on the autistic spectrum.
Yes.
Which he's kind of suspected, you know, he suspected something was wrong. And he's trying so hard to relate to the grandson, but he doesn't really know how, and they're not quite connecting. What's it like acting with a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old who's playing somebody with autism, and I may say is doing a great job at it?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary challenge for that boy, and he's done a great job. It does take patience because his concentration levels and spans are not that of an adult and an adult trained actor. It's his first acting performance, and it is the great challenge for the production. You know, there will be takes that he does where he is too engaged, you know, he is too, for want of a better word, normal. So the directors invented certain phrases like go into your dream world, etc. And it was a learning experience.
Yeah, and as a character, you're trying to get the boy to engage, and yet this young actor has to not engage with you. So it must be really tricky for you when you're trying so hard to engage him, knowing that it's the young actor's job to just disconnect and
To
be in another world, be
That's
on another
right.
wavelength.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Morris is making the classic mistake, which I actually made.
Morris is your character, yeah.
Yes, Morris is making the classic mistake, which I made with my father when he began to suffer from vascular dementia, of trying to bring my father, and Morris tries to bring the boy, into Morris's world, where in fact what you have to do is you have to go into their world and play it by their rules. And that is the journey for the entire family, dealing with the individual rather than dealing with the condition, because there is a very specific individual in there. But you know what Peter Bowker, who wrote the series, is so skillfully woven in, is that you could probably locate Morris somewhere on the spectrum. Morris definitely has a inability to understand the emotional impact on people of some of the things that he says and does. I think what Peter has done is he's suggested that the grandfather and the boy are linked. And indeed, throughout the whole series, what the writer is highlighting is whether people are autistic or not, communication is difficult for all of these people.
You've mentioned during this interview that your father had dementia during the last 13 years or 14 years of his life, and it was diagnosed as vascular dementia. Is that something different from Alzheimer's?
Yes, I believe it is. I think it manifests itself. Alzheimer's, as I understand it, and my understanding is somewhat rudimentary, Alzheimer's, what you often find with people suffering from Alzheimer's is that the past becomes the present. The memories of the past become much stronger and the memories of the present much weaker. So hence, you will find them sometimes walking down a motorway, insisting that they do not live in the house that they are currently in, that their house is somewhere else. My father's vascular dementia was really about a profound erosion of short-term memory. We didn't have the level of confusion of past and present. He just lost his short-term memory. Basically, you forget who you are. So obviously, he would get lost. He would fly into paranoid rages. He threw myself, my two brothers, out of the house because he didn't recognize us. And in his mind, he was protecting his wife, my mom. He was diagnosed in 2000. Once they diagnosed him, we realized suddenly the penny drops, you know. You go, so when he was doing that in 1998, so he was really suffering from about 1997, and he died in late 2012. And for all but the last year of his life, my mum kept him at home. And the big issue around dementia is the carers, often family members, who do incredible. What my mother did for my father was incredible. And she said to me, she said, Chris, the worst day of my life was not when your dad died. It was when I put him in that home. But myself and my brothers had to insist, really, because it was going to kill her. The burden of care was going to kill her. Because she had to do absolutely everything for him, you know.
When things happened, like your father throwing you out of the house because he didn't recognize you, he didn't believe that you were his son.
Mm-hmm.
How did you learn to deal with things like that? Because you can't logically convince him that you are his son. I mean, if he has dementia, well, logic isn't going to work. So what did you do? Well, how did you approach that?
You make mistakes. I took my mother and father again to Cornwall for a break. And I was sat with my father and we're doing a crossword, which myself and my father had done since a very young age. You know, it was one of our ways of expressing love for each other. It's something that we did. And I read out a clue. My dad was sat to my left, and he was pretty far on with the dementia. And I read out a clue saying, six letters, dictator. And quick as a flash, my dad said, despot. Quick as a flash. This is a man who could not really take himself to the toilet, to the bathroom. He said, despot. And I thought, wow, you know, I would have said Hitler or Stalin. You know, this, you know, it's... So... I looked at him and I said, "What? Nice one, pal." We always had this banter. I said, "Oh, I love that word, pal. Nice one." And as I'm writing it down into the crossword, I felt him staring at me very fiercely. And he said to me, "Are you related to me?" And I looked at him and I said, "Yeah, I'm your son." And he said, "What? You're my son? Where'd you get that from?" I said, "Well, Dad, I'm Chris. I'm your son." And my dad became extremely agitated, and he went into the room and he said, "This bloke here," said to my mum, Elsie, he said, "Elsie, this bloke here, he's telling me that I'm his father. I don't know what he's talking about." Now, what was going on was my father thought I was suggesting that he had had me out of wedlock. Therefore, that would be a threat to his relationship with my mother, his carer. Now, the great mistake I made there was that I tried to bring him back into my world for my own emotional needs. What I understood from that time, because it got very distressing, because we were in a cottage by the sea and he was very, very agitated. He got very, very angry at my mother in the bedroom because he felt she was going to turn against him because he'd had a child out of wedlock. I hope you're following this.
Yes.
But I, from that moment on, I understood that I cannot impose reality on my father. I cannot bring him into my world. I have to go into his. So I stopped calling him Dad. I would call him mate or pal. And if he thought I was a taxi driver, then I was a taxi driver. And I dropped all the expectation. And I became what he needed me to be, which was... you know, "Hello, pal, how are you?" You know, I'd say, "How are you doing, mate? You okay? How's Elsie?" You know, his mum. And I wouldn't say mum, I'd say, "How's Elsie? Is she all right?" "Yeah, she's fine, she's fine." You know, you have to go into their world. There was a moment once, my mum, for instance, her needs, he was sat in his chair, my mother was on the sofa, and my mum said, "Ronnie, do you know who I am?" And he looked at her and he said, "Yeah, of course I do." She said, well, "Who am I?" And he looked at her and he said, "I don't know, but I love you." You know, things like that. And there was also a sweet spot with my father's illness, which was quite early on, perhaps not long after the diagnosis, when he still knew that myself, Alan and Keith were his sons. There was a sweet spot where, this is a very, very working class male, you know, went to work in heavy industry from the age of 14, very poor when he was growing up, tough man, not great at expressing his love physically or verbally. The three of us all had experiences where we went to visit them and he insisted on walking us up the path and back to our cars. And with me in particular, he said to me, he got me to the car and he said, hey, cock. And I turned around and he said to me, I love the bones of you, you know. Now, I love the bones of you. It's a very Salford expression. He would never have said that. But there was this sweet spot where what happens with dementia is their inhibitions are destroyed, you know. But there was a sweet spot where those inhibitions about being demonstratively loving, but what I've realised, because my dad was, though not very well educated, he was a very intelligent man and really missed his way. He was saying goodbye. Is what he was doing. He knew.
Well, Christopher Eccleston, I love your acting, and it's just been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for sharing so much of your life with us.
Thank you for giving me so much time.
Christopher Eccleston speaking with Terry Gross. Eccleston co-stars in the HBO series The Leftovers, its third and final season premiere Sunday. He also co-stars in the BBC series The A Word, which was on the Sundance TV cable channel last year and can now be seen on iTunes and Amazon. A second season of The A Word is now in production. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film The Lost City of Z. This is Fresh Air.